I'm back in the story of Esther this evening, which you'd think that I'd planned for Mother's Day, wouldn't you? I hadn't, but I'm going to claim it. You know, it's one of those moments like this beautiful woman, strong woman of faith, of courage, wisdom. And, you know, I've been actually really impacted by the story of Esther, what an incredible woman she is. Now, this is a mini two-parter that I started last week and I'm finishing up today. And the title that I talked about last week is just this concept that God is always working. Whether we can see it, whether we can feel it, but God is always moving. God is always orchestrating things. Now, today I've got I don't know whether it's a catchy title. I'm not sure about it. I've called today, Every Knee Will Bow and Every Wall Will Fall. Just the deafening silence was just incredible. But every knee will bow and every wall will fall. So let me give you a tiny recap in 1 minute of what we looked at last week. I'm just aware that not everybody will have been here. Some of you will really know the story of Esther, but for some of you, this is quite new. So King Xerxes throws a massive party. In fact, he has 180 days of showing off how incredibly wealthy he is, followed by a banquet for 7 days. At the end of the banquet, he invites up his queen, who's called Queen Vashti, and he's a bit like, please come and parade yourself in front of all my mates. I want to show off how beautiful you are. Queen Vashti, in her infinite wisdom, turns him down and says, that's a terrible idea. I am not going to do that. And so King Xerxes basically dethrones her. So the hunt is on for a new queen. They send out commissioners into all parts of the Persia at that time. And so 127 different provinces. They come back with ladies who come to be a part of the king's harem for that next year. They have various beauty treatments during that period. But the upshot is that Esther is the queen that is chosen by the king. Now, a key detail that you need to know is that at no point does Queen Esther tell the king that she is Jewish. And that is really a big part of this story. So things are going well into chapter 3 of Esther. And we have the villain who is called Haman. And Haman becomes upset with Esther's uncle, who's called Mordecai. He's also a Jew, and the issue is that Mordecai will not bow down to Haman, and because he believes in God, he's not going to bow down. And so what happens is Haman gets incredibly frustrated, goes into a fit of rage, and then says, as a result, I want to actually annihilate the Jews who are in the Persian Empire at this point. So, I mean, it's a huge thing. Goes to the king, King Xerxes, who writes a decree that, saying that this is actually going to happen. So we have got a genocide moment on our hands. So that's kind of the backdrop. And it's so important to understand the scale of what we're talking about in this moment. So hugely awful moment. So Mordecai comes to Esther and says, Esther, you cannot stand by and just watch. You are married to the king. You have got to do something. You have got to act. Maybe you've come to be the queen for such a time as this, which will be a very famous verse that many of you will heard about. So I spent some time last week in chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. I'm just going to pick it up. It says, then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. I think that's like, for me, probably the most profound part of the book. And if I perish, I perish. I am willing to lay it all down. I know that this could cost me my life, but actually I have no choice. I have to do this before the Lord. I've got to give this a go. I've got to try and use the influence that I've been given because I'm the queen for this moment. And I spoke last week about how Esther, before she went into the king's throne room, she went into God's throne room. And that's the picture of what we have for these 3 days. What she does is she fasts and she prays and she calls everybody that she knows and she's like, we have got to intercede. So rather than just rushing, bang, straight into this next moment, she's like, no, this is an intercession moment. Call the people to pray. The future of her people and her life are on the line. Now, God was preparing Esther in the waiting. And so I just want to start by coming back into this passage, this chapter 4 piece, and just saying there is something profound going on in the waiting. Now, I don't know about you, any of you who have to wait for anything in life, but generally we hate waiting, don't we? It's like waiting for anything, waiting for news, waiting for news about a job, a relationship, an illness, waiting for results in exams, waiting to have a baby, waiting for God to break in. When we've decided that we want to see something, it's like, oh, but I'm in the waiting. And anybody that tells you otherwise is lying. I just haven't met somebody that's like, do you know what I really love to do in life? I love to wait. I love to be really frustrated in waiting. It's like, what's wrong with you? So waiting is really hard when we care about something or somebody. Now, I've noticed this in my own life this week. I'm waiting for some news. And I have felt deeply grumpy all week. Like, confession moment. And anybody that's been around me this week knows that I've been grumpy. It reached the point where Paul Crutchley, who many of you will know, he kind of WhatsApped me this week and was like, yeah, mate, just checking in. You okay? I thought, oh, man, is it that obvious? You know, when you get that moment, you're like, are you okay, James? And I'm like, no, I'm grumpy. Like, just that official moment of I'm grumpy because I'm waiting. I'm waiting for a situation and I'm waiting for some news about something. But at least you know that I'm speaking out my experience. It's not that I always get this right. Now, the Lord spoke a word to me. So I want you to go back a week. Last Wednesday, the Lord spoke to me really, really profoundly and really clearly. It was not a prophetic word from somebody else. It was a moment in my time with the Lord where he spoke a word. And he said, I want you to stand on that word. And I've utterly failed to do that all week. And I don't say that in kind of a, oh, I've really failed in this moment. The Lord gave me a word that I just hadn't been able to hold. And on Thursday this week, I suddenly took that word and I was like, oh, I can now hold it. My situation hasn't changed. What happened was, I was like, I have got to fast because I'm not okay. I'm really grumpy. I'm not nice to be around. I've got to see the shift. Now, I don't know when this piece, sorry, it's not an illness thing, just so you know, I don't want to shake you all. Do you know what I mean? And be like, oh, what's going on with James? It's nothing that most of you will care about. But in my life, it's a big deal. And on Thursday, I was like, I've got to pray about this. I've got to see some breakthrough because I don't know when this situation is going to shift. And actually, on Thursday, I had this moment where I was like, oh, I felt the release of the Lord. It's like, oh, it shifted. My circumstance hasn't changed, but it shifted, and I feel completely different. And I'm just aware that in the Christian life, so many of us have to wait, don't we? I mean, it's just part of life, waiting. And so the Lord, you know, we see in Esther the wisdom in the way that she waits. And so the phrase that I want to give you is strength in the waiting. Strength in the waiting. Esther was determined to wait on the Lord and allow him to guide her thoughts and help her frame her words. During a waiting period, God is not only working in our hearts, he's also working in others' hearts. And I think that's, again, what we're going to see later in the story, is that God wasn't just working in Esther, he was working in the king. And it was his perfect timing that came about. Now, I just want to dive. There is a beautiful part in Isaiah 40, verse 31. And I just want to take a moment just to unpack this because I felt like the Lord was like, I want you just to speak into this strength in the waiting this evening. Some of you will know this, but they that wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Now, some of you will know that as a song. They that wait on the Lord. I'm not going to sing it for you. I felt like I had a backing crew there. So my point is, waiting is part of life, but is so foundational to our faith. And from this little passage in Isaiah, we learn some really, really important things. The first thing is, they that wait on the Lord will renew their strength. There is a strengthening that occurs when we wait on the Lord. We may feel weak. We may feel intimidated. What happens while we're waiting is we exchange our weakness for the Lord's strength. So we come before him maybe in our brokenness, sometimes our uselessness, sometimes our doubts, and we bring that before the Lord. And what the Lord does in the waiting is that he strengthens us. They that wait on the Lord will renew their strength. We're not just waiting, we're waiting on him. We're waiting on him. So it's not this passive thing. When we think of waiting as just, I'm waiting for this. No, it's like, Lord, I'm waiting on you. I'm waiting on what you're going to do. So secondly, we then get a better perspective. So the first thing is we gain new strength. The second is that we get a better perspective. Eagles, I don't know if you know much about eagles, but eagles have incredible eyesight. So an eagle will be up really high in the air. And whether it's, let's imagine that they see a fish in the water, and then they come, don't they, and they go bang straight into the water. But what happens when they're up high is that they gain perspective, that they can see all around. What happens when we wait with the Lord is that the Lord changes our perspective. So again, the circumstance may not change, but the way that we look at it does. Because we step back and it's almost like that ability to be able to say, Lord, help me see as you see. It's like putting on God's glasses, isn't it? It's like, God, I don't know what's going on here. How do you see this? We gain new perspective. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. Thirdly, we store up extra energy. We will run and not be weary. Notice it's future tense. When we do encounter the thing that we've been dreading, we will encounter it with new strength. Extra energy will be ours to use. And then finally, we deepen our determination to persevere. We will walk and not become faint. So it's like, I'm going to keep on. And the Lord whispers reassurance to us. So just to go through that again, when we wait with the Lord, we gain new strength, we gain better perspective, like that eagle looking up from on high. We store up extra energy and we would deepen our determination to persevere. It's so important how we wait. There will be so many things that we wait on in this life. At the same time, during a period of waiting, it can feel like everything's invisible, isn't it? It's like, Lord, where are you in this moment? And you could easily tell yourself, I'm waiting in vain, nothing's going to change. But when the enemy's message comes into your mind, you need to kick it out and you need to reject it. And you need to say, Lord, what is it that you're doing in the waiting? How are you forming me in the waiting? That was a mini tangent about waiting. But it's not, it's really my first point. Strength in the waiting. The way that Esther waited was so beautiful. And then we come into this point, if I perish, I perish. If I die approaching the king and trying to save my people, I die doing the right thing. And her posture changed. Esther's posture changed from one of just fear into that moment of faith, doesn't it? Of like, I have no other choice, Lord. I am going to do this. I'm going to step into this moment. Now, I want to pick up chapter 5. So we've delved into chapter 4. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. If you've got your Bibles, just grab them. Come up on the screens behind me. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Esther has this courage in front of the king. Now, there's some things that we need to remember. No king has ever intimidated God. I know that sounds really obvious, but we in this world, often we're kind of overwhelmed by other people, aren't we? It's like, no king's ever intimidated God. God can handle anyone. Absolutely anyone. And Esther walks in that confidence. She stands before the king reconciled with God. She knows the cost. She's aware of the risk. When the king saw her standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight and he extended his golden scepter to her. And remember, without that gesture from the king, she would die. And now confident, she touches the top of the scepter, making a connection with the king. Into verse 3. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you. If it pleases the king, replied Esther, let the king together with Haman come today to a banquet I've prepared for him. I love that. Esther doesn't know what to expect. And the king simply says, what's on your mind? What's troubling you? In fact, he goes even further. He says, what can I do for you? Esther, just name it. What is it that I can do for you? There's no limit up to half the kingdom. He's saying there's no limit to what I want to do. Just name what you want me to do. Now, this is her moment. And you can imagine Esther being like, right, it's time to step through this door. What does she do? She holds back. She's like, because it's not the Lord's timing yet. She isn't in a hurry. She's not revengeful. You know why? Because she's been waiting on the Lord and she's been strengthened in the waiting. And look at her response. This is beautiful. And Esther said, if it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I've prepared for him. I want him to come to this banquet. I want you to realize for 3 days, Esther's been fasting. What's she been doing at the same time? Preparing a banquet. Isn't that amazing? So in her fasting, she's preparing a banquet for the king, but she's still fasting. Notice what Esther doesn't do. She doesn't point a finger at Haman at this point. She doesn't rush ahead telling the king what's troubling her. She doesn't play on his emotions or try to manipulate him by bursting into tears. She very calmly says, I've planned a banquet and I'd love to have you and Haman attend. Great idea, the king says. Banquets are my thing. That's not actually in the text. But we know that the king loves a good party, so she's got him. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman come to the banquet which Esther had prepared. While at the banquet, the king asks again, what can I do for you, Esther? And her response comes again. Come again to the banquet that I'm going to do tomorrow. This thing's dragging out, isn't it? It's like, okay, you've been to this banquet. Do you know what? I'm going to do another one tomorrow. Why don't you come? And I will then tell you what I want you to do. Haman comes out of this banquet. He's the villain, just so that you remember. He comes out of this banquet so pleased that Esther's invited him. And he goes back to his family and he starts boasting. He's like literally beaming. Oh, you never guess where I've been. I've been at a banquet with Esther and the king. You know, this is the culmination of his life. He's like, this is amazing. He's feeling so proud of himself. And then he also goes to them, well, do you know what? What's even more amazing? I'm going back tomorrow because I'm that great. But we pick it up in Esther 5, verse 13. He says this. So he's boasting to his family, but all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. So as he comes out of the banquet, he sees Mordecai the Jew, and suddenly he's full of a fit of rage all over again. He's got angry. Verse 14, his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits. Just so you know, 50 cubits is 75 feet. Just picture that in your mind. That's really high. That's 51 and a half feet to the ceiling. I've just made that up. I've got absolutely no idea how high it is to the ceiling. I just thought if I said it confidently enough, you'd all be like, wow, that guy's pretty smart, isn't he? I mean, it's a complete lie, but I've got no idea. That's probably not 75 feet. It's higher than that. So when we're talking about this picture of the, what's it called? Pole. I'm really sorry. It's the second can of Pepsi Max has literally messed with me. You know, I tell you what, it's one thing having a mind blank when there's nobody looking at you. There's another when you're like, there's nothing in there. And they're all looking at me thinking, what's the word, pole? Yeah, great. So basically, if at any point during this you see me blank, just shout out a word. And I'm happy to go with it. But have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. This suggestion delighted Haman and he had the pole set up. He's a lovely character, isn't he? He's soft, he's warm, he's cuddly. He's the kind of guy that you'd like, I'd love this guy to be my friend. So that's the picture. He set up this pole. Now, as we tip into chapter 6, we have this incredible God breakthrough moment. And it's really not what you would expect. It's right here, verse 1 of chapter 6. The king cannot sleep. The king cannot sleep. And you think, well, James, why is that such a big breakthrough moment? This tiny, insignificant moment, why is it so important? Let's find out. 6 verse 2. So while the king can't sleep, he orders them to bring him the book of kind of his reign, of what's been going on. And so he starts reading about some of the things that happened. Verse 2, it was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthania and Teresa, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway and who'd conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. So what happening is, as the king is having somebody read to him, because he's too tired and can't be bothered to open his eyes, he's just lying in bed, and he's having some of the stories of his reign read to him, he realizes that Mordecai and Esther had foiled an assassination attempt on his life, but at no point had he ever done anything to thank Mordecai for this moment. So can you see how this really innocuous moment of the king's having, can't sleep, decides to get out a book and start reading about it, and in this moment he starts reading about Mordecai and goes, everything's got to change. What honor and recognition, verse 3, has Mordecai received for this, the king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answer. The turning points of life and the significant events are often subtle. We have to learn to see God in the small moments. And a sensitive heart is required to detect these changes. In the mystery of God's timing, subtle things occur that the sensitive heart can pick up. And that's the role that wisdom plays in life. Reading life's subtleties is what Christian maturity is all about. And rather than kind of thrashing around and thinking, I'm not going to make it through this, I'll never hear God's voice, we determine in wisdom to watch for the slightest turning of events. I was reminded as I was preparing this of Elijah. And he has that moment in the presence of the Lord in 1 Kings 19. So there's this powerful wind that comes past. And then there's this earthquake. And then there's this fire. And the Bible says, and the Lord was not in any of those things. The Lord was in the gentle whisper afterwards. And that's what I mean, is that so often in life, we're looking for the big moment. And actually, it's the subtle moments. It's the little moments. This whole story changes on this moment. Now, you have to realize that King Xerxes was not a Christian. But the Lord messed with him. He starts reading about Mordecai. It changes everything. Esther's been praying. She's been fasting and praying. It's like, God, you've got to break in. God, you've got to break in. God breaks in. It's just not the way that we would expect him to. God is always working. And as Christians, we're learning to see the fingerprints of God. I often sit with people as they're making big decisions in their life. It's the moment that they give me a ring. Like, James, I'm just thinking about, shall I move city? Shall I take a job? Shall I marry this person? And do you know what? It's a real honor that in that moment people would want to speak to you about their life. They want to bring you in on that. And so when I sit with them, one of the questions that I love to ask is, what's the God story? Can you see God's fingerprints in the journey? What is it that God's been doing? And it's not always what you would think. It's often not the big things, but it's the little things. It's a culmination of little events that happen, little guidances, lots of little decisions following the talents and the passions that the Lord has given you. A nudge here, a confirmation there, an invitation, a small answer to prayer, a change in attitude. What's the God story? Where can you see that God has been moving and working? God orchestrating, God leading, God intervening. Now, obviously, the story of Esther is massive with huge ramifications for the Jewish people. But what I love is that God is moving in the little moments as well. And this moment of the king not being able to sleep, is that for me? It's God breaking in. It's his deliverance. Now, think about it for a moment. If Esther had... in that first banquet, if Esther had come before the king, before the king's had this moment of realization about Mordecai, I wonder whether the story would have been different. It's beyond my pay grade, if I'm honest, but I just wonder. God's timing is perfect. Pick it up in the story. The king said, "Who is in the court?" Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about impaling Mordecai on the pole he'd set up for him. His attendants answered, "Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in," the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Now, Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honor than me?" He's slightly arrogant, isn't he? So what he's thinking is, in this whole exchange with the king, Haman is thinking that the king wants to honor him. He hasn't realized that this is all about Mordecai. He's reading it through the long lens. So he answered the king, verse 7, "For the man the king delights to honor." And it's almost like he stands back thinking of himself, "What would I like for myself? Well, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse that the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.'" "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you've suggested for Mordecai the Jew." Boom. "Who sits at the king's gate, do not neglect anything you have recommended." This is the divine reversal happening right here. Isn't it powerful? It's like, oh. So Haman got the robe and the horse, and he robed Mordecai, and he led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him. And you can imagine him doing this like through like gritted teeth, can't you? "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor." It's just this awful moment for him. Afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. He'd had a bad day. The story turns on its head, bang, all because the king couldn't sleep. It's all shifted. Now, in chapter 7, we move on, and Esther, Haman, and the king are having their second banquet. Do you remember? Esther invited him to the first one, and then at the second one, she's like, "And now I'm going to tell you what I'd love you to do. What's your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." That's the king speaking. "Then Queen Esther answered, 'If I found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people, this is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we'd merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king.'" You have to remember, up until this moment, the king does not know that she is Jewish. So this, for the king, is one of those moments. It's like, oh my goodness, I was about to annihilate your whole people. Because he hasn't realized. Haman has fed him this kind of thing. "Why don't you do this?" And the king, I don't know what's going on with the king, but he's just like, "Yeah, that's fine." Wow. So in this moment, it all comes clear. It's like, oh my goodness. King Xerxes, verse 5, asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he, the man who's dared to do such a thing?" Esther said, "An adversary and an enemy, this vile Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. It's all shifted. I said right at the beginning that I wanted to call this talk, "Every knee will bow and every wall will fall." Haman's in big trouble, and his fate is to be hung on the gallows that he created. And that's what happens to him. The gallows that he created for Mordecai, he gets hung on himself. His whole world comes tumbling down and he has a time of reckoning. One day, every single one of us will stand before Jesus and give an account of our life. It's a big moment, isn't it, when you think about it? Like, that's what the scriptures talk about. We are going to give an account of the way that we've lived. Every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Everything will be brought into the light. Every injustice will be righted. So there is breakthrough now, and we see that in this story, but there is also breakthrough in the future. There's redemption in the future. Because the truth is, we go through this life, sometimes there are moments of breakthrough, like I've said, but there are some things that might happen in our life that will never be righted in this life. There are some injustices that might well happen to us that can't be righted. But one day, everything will come out before the Lord. All walls will fall eventually. No matter how well constructed or long-standing they are, the walls will fall. The walls may be intimidating, like King Xerxes, or in your own life, it could be something very different. It could be a relationship. It could be something that's happened in your family. But all walls will finally fall. A few years later, Joshua invaded the promised land near Jericho. And to the naked eye, it was this imposing structure of stone. But it was nothing in the presence of the living God. And three words tell it all. In Joshua 6, verse 20, the wall collapsed. It looked impenetrable. This situation for Esther looked impossible, didn't it? It's like, how is this ever going to shift? And how does she take down that wall? She took it down by prayer and fasting. She took it down in the spiritual. It shifted. The Lord broke in. The Lord intervened. The wall came down. In the final analysis, Christ conquers. And as Paul wrote, he himself is our peace and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, Ephesians 2:14. In the words of Betsy Ten Boone, there is no pit so deep but that he is not deeper still. To borrow again from Betsy's words, there is no heart so hard that he cannot change it. There is no writing so permanent that he cannot erase it. There is no scene so dark that he cannot brighten it. God can break into any situation. Every wall will fall, but more importantly, every knee will bow. No heart is so stubborn that God cannot penetrate it. No will is so determined that he cannot break through it. No one, no matter who, and no matter how powerful, is a match for the living God. And you know what? That brings me great comfort. Sometimes I don't understand. I don't understand how things are going to work out. But it's such a relief to know that the Lord is in charge and that he has the power to do anything. God holds it all together. Just in finishing, chapter 8 says this: that same day King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he'd reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Can you see? It keeps going, this story of reversal. Mordecai takes Haman's place. And then in the last couple of chapters, we see the overriding of the decree that's gone out, that Esther actually comes before the king and begs him. It's like, you've got to do something to change this decree. And so what he does is he writes another decree, and it's actually Mordecai who writes the decree on behalf of the king, basically saying that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves against any attack. And so what you see is that the Jews do defend themselves, and they actually are victorious in many of the battles that follow. So in finishing, I think that that what we learn from Esther is that there is strength in the waiting. We see it in her. That we are learning to see the fingerprints of God. And that finally every knee will bow and every wall will fall. Why don't you stand?